ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing innovation strategist, keynote speaker, author of Think Like a Futurist, and founder of the think tank, The Push Institute, Cecily Somers. Cecily is a global trends analyst who tracks significant global trends and their implications for business, government, and nonprofit sectors over the next 5, 10, 25 to 50 years. Cecily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So you're currently a futurist, innovation strategist, and author, but your path to this now state is both interesting, and I think it informs what you do. And so I thought we could start by having you take our audience on the Google Map tour of how you arrived where you are today.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I certainly didn't grow up thinking that I was going to become a futurist. I found my way to it by first being a dancer. I began training as a ballet dancer when I was 5 years old and pursued that very seriously and danced for about 25 years. So that was really my first career. And it has absolutely shaped who I am, how I approach the world, and what I do in my work now. I really credit my understanding of the creative process and of the kind of diligence of staying with something when you don't know the outcome to what it took to go into the studio every day and do the same exercises and to go to rehearsal and try things out and also to have a sense that you're never done. That there are always wonderful things to do and to explore, but that you're never done in the discovery of your body, of yourself, and of what more you can do. So that was career number one, was being a professional dancer. I transitioned from dance to chiropractic. I became a chiropractor because I had been teaching anatomy. That was a fluke, as so many, you know, choices in life are. That was a surprise to me that when I got my bachelor's, I had to take anatomy and did well. And I started teaching at the University of Illinois and then later in Chicago when I was dancing there. And so when I hit up against my own crabbiness is the truth, my own crabbiness in my life as a dancer, I had to really evaluate what was going to make me uncrabby and maybe more importantly, more happy. And that I had to confess when I really took a look at it that the concern for me was that there was just a lack of power and agency about following my own mind and doing my own work that I didn't really feel I had as a dancer, much less the power agency of not making very much money. So I chose to become a chiropractor and used that really as a license, literally a medical license to be somebody who could really explore what healing looked like and studied Chinese medicine and homeopathy and built a clinic and bought a clinic and continued to really discover. The next discovery was that I loved business, that I loved that creative process of making something from who you are and bringing it into the world and having a point of view about that. So that was career number two, was being a chiropractor and a small business owner. And through that time, always teaching and doing workshops and training other people. And that turned itself into consulting. And that I began really in doing healthcare and brand strategy. And over time developed the whole piece of who you are in context to the world, that that's where relevance lies. And took me, you know, a few steps further into, and so what's happening in the world and what does that look like and how do we make sense of it? And would say that now as a futurist, which is how I do that work, I have really brought together my core being as an artist, and understanding that there is no certainty, there is just creation, and how to actually have a discipline for that, combined with the systems thinking and diagnosis that I was trained in and also trained others in clinical sciences. How do you pull all of the evidence together and try to find a path and figure out where do you start? And that's really what it is. It's like to work in healthcare, certainly, and ask those very big questions. So I do that now in strategy and innovation, those kind of basic approaches of thinking of the creative process and the diagnostic systems thinking applied to trend work and brand work. So that's the long backhand into how I approach my work, but also what my path to it has been.
Fantastic. So it's actually very perfect to speak with you today, because as this futurist, and you're studying the forces of change and help people, businesses, and institutions meet the challenges that are coming down the pike, we've arrived in an economy at a place where I think it would be fair to say that the business environment is permanently volatile. And so what I'm interested in is the large trends that you see driving this change and what it means for existing businesses and business models. And particularly if we could start with decentralization.
Oh, yeah. So the trends that we see are expressive of some really deep structural forces. And decentralization is one of them. So let me just step back a moment and say that I look at everything. I look at all change as essentially arriving from four fundamental forces that shape our society. And it's an economic view. So this speaks to why decentralization is growing so strong. That if we understand that the kind of the main purpose, the project that we have as groups, as social groups, has a core economic purpose, so that we are coming together to do more and have more and be more and give more together than we can do alone, and that productivity piece is really what drives a lot of change. So that when our tools for production change, it really drives social change at all levels. And that's what's happening with decentralization. So we have tools of production, communication technologies, we have 3D printing, we have the Internet of Things, we have all kinds of things that now begin to return the power to produce and create and distribute all by ourselves. You know, we are entrepreneurs, and we are doing small businesses, and we are creating social movements and microfinance and micro work because we have these tools that say the power of the individual is to start something. And that's really the beginning of decentralization. And it is a trend that will only grow deeper because our tools are growing deeper in how much power they give to the individual.
Okay, and just going back to make sure we didn't miss anything. So the four structural forces you see, what would you, if we were just to list them out, what would they
be? They are resources. So when groups come together, they take a look at what their raw materials are. You know, what do we have to work with? And that includes energy and land and sun and food and all the basics that come from nature. Okay. And then the next force is technology. And technology is a broad term for what are the tools that we use to extract, to pull out those raw materials and then do something with them so that we can make, you know, shelter and food and manufacturing plants and shuttles that take us to the moon, and that's all done through technology. The third force is really considering who do you have working together, and so that's demographics. Your labor force makes a huge difference in terms of how well you have a cohesive team and how much you can do together and how well people create value and have good lifestyles, essentially. And then finally, we have to have the fourth force, which is governance, which is how do we how do we come to some kind of common understanding about how we cooperate? And we do that through the rule of law and the rule of markets. And so government is one form of governance, which is always reactive. We're always making up rules kind of in reaction to the change that's coming up through those first three.
Right.
So, yeah, those are the four.
So how does hierarchy fit within that? Like if we're decentralizing because we are able to produce and create and distribute, then hierarchy and control is destabilized. And then as a business, which is operating in this environment, how important is a visionary leadership and a singular point of view for success? Is that still a key to success, or is it actually a key to missing the mark?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. There is no single answer for sure. So that we are at an inflection point in which our centralized structures, you know, the organizations that we had that, you know, technology-led centralization was that we had tools where we could produce a lot and then distribute at a distance. And those are called factories and they're called big businesses where you can have a headquarters and then send your product or services out at a distance because we have planes, trains, and automobiles to carry them.
Or in an entertainment lens, you had a limited number of networks which were distributing all of your content to everybody and they controlled it. So I just want to always also bring it back to entertainment, media, communications, what does it mean for them within this thinking?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And that, of course, was before, you know, nobody could afford a television camera or studio or the talent to do it. And here we are being able to do podcasts and iMovies and all kinds of things. So yes, it's a direct reflection of that. So centralization is, you know, this hierarchical structure that all of our legacy institutions have are struggling right now. I would say across the board that every sector, every industry, every geography is dealing with one of model, and it is the model you named of how do we live in a fast and furious world where the power to produce is in the many, and we're still trying to control it. We're still trying to control it through these centralized structures. So we're at a time of transition, and change always takes a while, and currently, many organizations are playing with agile systems or design thinking or flat hierarchies or what's called the responsive organization movement because they feel it. They feel this change and they understand that hierarchy, if nothing else, is an incredibly slow way to move in the world because the decision making lies at the top and you have to wait for, you know, request to go all the way up and some kind of feedback to come all the way down before you can make any move. And that does not fit the pace of change today. And so that's the challenge that everyone is trying to answer and doing it in some interesting ways.
But you've also, I'm sure, heard the expression, a horse by committee is a camel, you know? So flat organizations and flat where everybody has a voice in it. Is there no point of view? Is there no singular vision? Is that, are we missing? Is there something that is necessary? And yes, decision-making can be slow in a hierarchical system, but it also can be directed. Somebody can make a choice and say, this is what we're going to do. You know, Steve Jobs, perfect example probably of that kind of vision shaping the company.
Absolutely. I think, you know, first of all, vision at that level isn't very common. It just isn't.
You mean the company man is not a visionary? They're very risk-averse.
Well, it's not designed to be. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, I'm always interested in the design of the system. And I think what we often miss is that the people who are iconic in their innovation and in their success, such as Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or Sergey and Larry or Mark Zuckerberg and many of them, is that the structure of their company is that they're typically founders. So that vision was really strong and they grew big businesses around them and they retained control. They retain majority stake so that they really can say to Wall Street, for instance, or to their board, who is there to support their vision, you know, we're working on something here. We're not going to play to just meeting, you know, the next highest stock price only. Whereas in publicly traded companies, you know, where there is no sole or majority stock owner, then what you are doing is you're having to answer to the share price. And so there isn't, the vision is not rewarded, long-term is not rewarded in that system. And that's what they're facing, all of their pressures. Everything is designed for the short-term. And it's an interesting thing in America because our systems, both our market system and our political system are built for the short-term. And so, you know, we don't invest in the long-term as well. What we do extremely well is we really have a great environment for entrepreneurs and for spinning things out fast.
Well, and that's interesting. I think I read in a Gartner report last year that 75% of companies that are currently on the S&P will be gone in 10 years. They'll just be gone. So how does long-term thinking, I mean, what is that a function of? Is that just the rapidity of change that even if you're responsive, it's just not, you just can't see what's coming down the pike. If you're successful, you're open to being destabilized because you won't see the disruption before it's too late. What's behind that?
Well, a lot of that has to do with, you know, all we have to do is look at how recently we've seen acquisitions. So what that report really points to is that companies in our system often get sold or merge, they change form. It doesn't mean that that many died. 75% are just going to collapse or fail. But, you know, Microsoft just bought LinkedIn, Verizon bought Yahoo, and, you know, a number of big shifts in that way. That's how our economy, how our market economy is really built to do it. Amazon bought the Washington Post a couple of years ago. It's interesting because a lot of these mergers are include media publishing entities, so that media is really starting to be a convergence in almost everything that we do, and companies see that and they want it.
How then, if you're a media company, you're a legacy traditional media company, a broadcaster, you're an NBC, ABC, CBS, how do you position yourself? So you've got an incredibly large organization. You've had organic growth. You've had organizational structures that are designed around people rather than function. How do you build a scaffolding to make yourself into a responsive and adaptive organization? What should the leaders of these companies be thinking is job one or task one?
Well, I have an approach that I refer to, which is saying hold tight to purpose. That you do really have to know who you are and what you stand for. And you know, if you're one of the big three, you have to have a point of view. I think this is the case for success in business across the board, is that you have to have a very clear point of view. But so you hold tight to purpose and then you play loose with tactics, which means that you're trying things out all the time. And that includes in media, especially, that you're always experimenting with the latest technologies. Media company that's done that really, really well, not broadcaster, but publisher, is The New Yorker. I'm just enthralled and so inspired by the way they have really modernized the way that they connect with people. But they have absolute fidelity with who they are as The New Yorker.
In an interview, I heard you use the term creative destruction. Can you describe what that means?
Oh, yes. You're willing to kill sacred cows. that you can change form. You know, we'll use The New Yorker again. You can try on different forms in order to reinvent yourself while, again, staying true at the same time. there's another broadcaster. This is a radio station in Seattle, KEXP, which started off as a small college station. And they do an exquisite job of staying true to who they are. And one of the things that they did, and I think this is really on the nose with regard to your question about how do you stay relevant? How do big companies or any company stay relevant? KEXP got very, very specific about their point of view and their brand and their mission, which is to say that we scour the world for great music that deserves to be heard wherever it's found, and we deliver it wherever music lovers want to hear it. So that means that they do it by a lot of streaming. They have a big studio now where they are building a television studio because they're meeting people online and not necessarily through the airwaves. And that the key to their success has been letting go of defining themselves as a radio station.
Honing into their mission and not their medium.
One of their successes, as an example, is that they go to this Iceland music festival, one of their excursions around the world, and in a living room there heard a band that we now know is very popular of Monsters and Men. And KEXP discovered them and thought that they were so fantastic that they wanted to give them airplay, introduce them to producers and labels, and to really help them get started. And that's another part of KEXP's mission, is to first attend to the music lovers who are distinctive in the kind of music lover is the one who loves to discover something new, who loves to hear great music, even if they don't like it. So that gives them the palette to go very, very broadly. And then second, they understand that their audience is the artists. And so they have a lot of services, and the ways that they produce music and connect with artists has to do with helping and developing and promoting them. And it's a beautiful model, a beautiful example of when you know who you are, you can hold tight to purpose and play loose with tactics. You can keep inventing in new media, but like The New Yorker and like KEXP, you have new ways to express and connect because it's the tools and the technologies that allow you to do that.
Right, right. Well, and now what's interesting, okay, so we talked about the tools and technologies, and we talked about the resources, but also I'm curious your view on the who and the demographics, because, you know, I've read about the fourth industrial revolution and the potential for significant and permanent underemployment. And what does that mean for all of for business, for these models?
My goodness. Some people refer to this time that goes along with the fourth industrial revolution as the precarity. There is a precariousness to people's lives and to our social structures that, when we move this quickly, we haven't really thought through what that means. So I would say the optimists around the techno-optimists tend to believe that, hey, we're always creating new forms of work and people will just retrain and figure it out and they'll be Uber drivers and entrepreneurs, and there will be that. And this is happening so quickly that I don't really think that that's true. I think there is probably a really great divide that is getting deeper. So the fourth industrial revolution refers to a couple of things. One of them is the Internet of Things and how big data flows through sensors that are embedded in our things and in our environment and in ourselves, and effectively automate and outsource tasks and information and everything in our environment. And so the question becomes, when you automate that much, what does happen to our labor force, and how do companies take advantage of that?
Well, how do they take advantage of it, and also what's the impact of it? I mean, one of the things that I've found interesting is how you cannot pay attention to something because it's outside, really outside your bailiwick. For instance, college debt. you know, why would a broadcast network need to be interested in college debt? Well, it turns out that if you come out when you have crushing college debt, you delay starting a household, and actually it affected many businesses. You know, the gig economy, the rental economy, the cord nevers, and all sorts of ways in which people had always behaved and business models were built on was upended. And you could trace it back in some ways to college debt.
Yes. That all of these, so I would say that there probably were some other forces that when you say that one of the implications of things like deregulation, you know, where we really favored everything becoming much more market driven. You know, that also began to have people go into debt for schools, and schools keep raising their prices.
Right.
So yes,
right.
But you're right, it's all connected, and that we do need to look very, very broadly. So the demographic piece that you were speaking to, for instance, you know, we have industrial economies, industrialized nations, right now are facing a very big challenge, which is the greatest part of their population is reaching 65 and older, and they don't have a labor force to support them. That, you know, so this is pensions and Social Security and Medicare, or some form of it in other countries. So this is a really critical economic challenge that is many countries the world over are facing. We need to figure out how do we connect labor in new places, in new ways. And some of it does come through our technologies now, where everybody's mobile. Some of them are moving, and so there's pressure on migration, and there's also big refugee movements. And there's some companies like General Electric does a very good job of this, invest in other parts of the world where they're, of course, building businesses, but they're training people and beginning to really engage with local economies so that they can integrate them more directly.
Great. We're coming towards the end of our interview, and there are some words I'd like to just rapid fire at you and just get your top of your head one word response. Don't overthink it. Just what do you think in response? First, for whatever comes first to mind, Facebook.
Great. Great way to connect with other people, and the fact that they have people at the center.
Google.
Engineers.
Snapchat.
Youth.
Twitter.
Lame.
Sorry. YouTube.
Growing like crazy.
Ad blockers.
More, please.
Art.
Central.
AI.
The future.
VR.
Also the future.
AR.
The combination.
And what are you watching for entertainment? Are you binging anything?
Well, I'd let you know that The New Yorker was really, I mean, one of the most beautiful things I've seen in a long time. I was completely addicted to it. And the other one that I have a similar attachment to is Chef's Table, which are profiles of chefs. And there is just a way in which they tell their story and go deep into the art of what they do that I find just so inspiring.
And what excites you most about the future?
I'm excited about the possibilities. I'm excited about people being more engaged with things that make them empathetic and engaged with humanity on a large scale.
Great. And what's up next for you? What's your next project that you're taking on?
Well, what I am involved in right now is a big project on the future of leadership for Google, in fact. So that's, you know, a lot of the questions you've asked, we've been exploring for them in particular.
Well, fantastic. That sounds really interesting. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have been indispensable to bringing this to life. As usual, first and foremost is the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thanks, Rob. Our production team over at Microfame Media, thank you. A big thank you to our guest and new friend, Cecily Summers. Thank you. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.